This week, the Dow Jones Industrials Average reversed course yet again, adding over 300 points to the week, while silver also finished in the plus column. Hello, everybody. Chris Waltzik back with you with another must-hear infotainment-filled show. We have two industry professionals and four phone callers this week in the listener's question and answer segment. This Friday wrapped up yet another action-packed week in the financial markets. All eyes and ears were focused firmly on next week's Fed meeting. Now, although many pundits expect the Fed to throw a curveball, making their first change in rate policy in nearly a decade, the current Fed funds futures indicate that Dr. Yellen and company might just hold rates steady with a 77% confidence level. So why is this so important? Does the Fed really hold all the cards? If the Fed raises rates, that would indicate that they expect very solid economic conditions ahead, strong enough to offset a lot of the negativity in the global economy. However, if they hold rates steady, investors might interpret that to indicate that maybe the domestic economy is not firing on all 12 cylinders. That could scare investors. Joining me in the episode to help make sense of the markets, two leading professionals with decades of combined experience at the helm of Merck Investments, Axel Merck, says the Fed might surprise the markets with a small rate hike next week. He offers a unique currency strategy that can reduce risk and increase expected returns of anyone's portfolio. Next, David Morgan says silver represents an excellent opportunity. Now that production is on the wane, demand could eclipse supply, setting the stage for much higher prices. But first, four longtime listeners are on the phone with their questions and comments. And then Robert Ian brings everyone across home plate with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Partly cloudy weather appeared over the New York COMEX exchange this week on dollar weakness and renewed rate hike expectations. Still, some investors sought refuge in the yellow metal, in the precious metals, and in particular silver, with increased global equities and currency market volatility. Gold shed only about $14, ending at $11.07. Silver added about 3 cents, finishing the week at $14.55 an ounce, while the XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index dropped 3.5 points, down 7% at $45, and West Texas Intermediate Crude gave back a dollar, down 2%, finishing at $44.80 per barrel. All eyes were on the Fed, with the big rate decision announcement scheduled for next Thursday. The Federal Reserve's monetary policy meeting is slated for Wednesday and Thursday. According to the implied probability on the Fed funds futures contracts, there is just less than a 77% chance that the Fed will hold rates steady at that 0 to 0.25%, and only a 23% chance that rates will climb up to 0.5% on next Thursday afternoon. Put simply, the Fed is likely to hold rates steady next week and move the rate hike to the next meeting in about 6 weeks or so. Precious metals, bottom line. Dollar weakness is just yet another sign of the low probability of a rate hike. Since investors don't expect rates to go up, the greenback is less attractive because related instruments will yield lower rates than its competitors, at least in the near term. Plus, equities volatility is turning some investors back to the precious metals safe haven. The XAU index is one bright star looking solid. If the FOMC holds rates steady as expected, I think the gold stocks might just surprise the bears with a solid rally. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, sunny skies over the New York Stock Exchange. Investors added oversold shares in anticipation that the Fed would hold rates steady. The Dow Jones Industrials added 2%, about 330 points, ending at 16,443. The S&P 500 ended at 1961, up 40 points, 2%. And the NASDAQ added 138, 3%, ending at 4822. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, fear is starting to recede from extreme levels in our seven-component sentiment index, and the VIX index is also showing signs of continued reversal. Should the Fed hold rates steady, investors could interpret the news, at least in the near term, as a sign of economic weakness that without the Fed's high-octane zero rate booster, earnings might not be as impressive in the fourth quarter. For the time being, the multi-year uptrend has been breached recently, and caution is still advisable. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio, first with our Q&A segment, and then on to our two top guests, all wrapped up with Robert Ian. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Opening up the phone lines for listeners' questions and comments.
Hello, Chris. This is Dave calling from California. Curious to find out about, I think you said you moved into a new place. I'm curious is whether you moved your permaculture setup with your tilapia and all that. Just curious to find out how that's going. Hopefully you still got it going on. Keep up the great work. Excellent interviews lately. Thanks.
First up, it's Dave from California. He asks about my family's tilapia and chickens. Well, hi, Dave. Actually, we still have our blue and Nile tilapia from our original stock, and we also have subsequent broods. They're pets. They're not for consumption. In addition, we still have our chickens, which continue to make great pets for our little ones in the family, as well as for their wonderful eggs. I'm a vegetarian, so I don't eat meat at all. In any way, shape, or form. And, you know, I'd like to encourage everyone who's interested to take the plunge. You know, it takes about a year to replenish the body, to remove all meat products from the body. And I'll tell you, after well over 12 months without any meat whatsoever, it's certainly been one of the greatest blessings in my lifetime. So anyone interested, I highly encourage you. But Dave, thanks for asking, and I hope that you're also taking steps to secure your family's future.
Hi, Chris. I love your show. I appreciate what you do. And my question is, what do you think of these stories that surface every so often that claim that somebody through alchemy have somehow been able to manufacture gold? In other words, without mining it, they just make it in the laboratory, I guess. I saw one recently on the Financial Survival Network webpage, and I've seen it in other places, and I would like your comments. Thank you.
And the next caller comments on creating gold through alchemy. Alchemy really has a bad rap. You know, even Sir Isaac Newton was a alchemist, if you will, although he is considered by many to be the father of modern physics in the form that we understand it today. Alchemy was one of his many, many, many passions. So as for whether or not we can produce it yet, produce gold, that is, through chemical processes, I have to say most likely not. As far as we know, it involves huge nuclear forces, such as an exploding star, a supernova. Under the right conditions in the laboratory, I do believe gold can be produced, but that's with an enormous energy expense. And of course, with that energy expense comes huge financial costs. So in other words, it's just not economical right now. I mean, sure, you could make a, you know, a hundredth of a gram or something, but if it costs several million dollars to produce that, what have you really done? That being said, I don't want to discourage folks who are interested and this is their passion. I do believe that eventually new exciting energy sources will be discovered, just like going from the steam age to the coal age, if you will, coal and steam, to now nuclear and petroleum and diesel. You know, these were massive increases, changed the world forever, helped spark a new industrial revolution. Well, similarly, I think we'll see things that we refer to now is free energy, such as tapping into graviton fields, things of that nature, where virtually limitless energy will be available to almost any researcher, and at that point in time, likely many, many decades, if not centuries in the future, with almost limitless energy at your fingertips, well, you can produce almost any metal that you'd like for virtually free. I do believe that this is quite possible, but I wouldn't expect to see it, in, at least not in my lifetime, and not likely in our kids' lifetime as well. For instance, you know, diamonds are produced regularly around the world in the laboratory, and many are sold on the market, and they're virtually flawless. However, they're not natural, and there's a lot of debate on whether or not this is realistic and what have you, but yes, they can produce diamonds. If you can produce diamonds, you can also produce gold. Very different process, but still, it is a possibility, just not cost-effective yet.
I just want to make a comment. and see if you could help me. Technically, the spot gold price finally gave way to the structurally bear market as prices plunged below 1138, which was nearly a year-long support. It is now 1095 as I speak. Every rally following the initial breakdown in 2013 has failed to exceed the prior rally, which supports the trend of selling into strength. The target of 1,000 represents the support of the 2008-2009 consolidation. The 2001 uptrend in the lower 800s over time will intersect the current downtrend. This, technically speaking, would be a good target objective. I'm aware of the tremendous worldwide demand for physical gold. Also aware of the depletion from the Western central banks sending gold to the East and possibility of a failure to deliver causing a short squeeze that could cause insolvency of many institutions, especially in the derivatives. I would appreciate if you could comment on how to rectify the differences in these two facts. I can't. It's a conundrum to me. Thank you.
George is up next. He uses technical analysis, which seems to indicate a buy in the yellow metal around 800 to 1,000, maybe strong support there. Well, first of all, long time no hear. Great to hear from you. Glad you're still listening to the show. You know, it sounds like you've been secretly subscribed to my Alpha Stocks newsletter, and this has been my target now for, I want to say, at least a year. And I've been on record, had the downtrend light up for several years, it seems now. If I understand the question correctly, you're perplexed, though, by this conflicting bearish signal you see in your technical work and the bullish global demand, of course, fundamental, where there could be a force majeure in the markets and or a derivative squeeze, thanks in part to this monetary machinations and repatriation of the yellow metal into national coffers around the globe. Many thoughts spring to mind here. Firstly, we've had several folks in the industry, some on the show, comment that the powers that be, such as the plunge protection team, could be shorting the precious metals sector in order to orchestrate a positive economic environment. This would be very easy to do, especially with silver. I mean, these are tiny markets relative to the Forex or the Dow Jones or, you know, I mean, they, you know, gold might comprise just a handful of the Dow Jones holdings in that index. Silver may be just the smallest component of the Dow 30. So it wouldn't take much firepower given massive derivatives leverage to manipulate these markets, especially if you're using Livermore-style tactics. However, I do think it's important for us to recognize the prevailing market bias. You know, this has just been my theme for a decade on this show. You notice that it's downward. I suggest that everyone who's interested direct their web browsers, bookmark it if you like, to stockcharts.com. 2001 to 2005, that period on the weekly chart. You can punch in, let's say, the $XAU, $gold, $silver, each independently. And I think you'll see, especially the XAU, pronounced consolidation, a trading range and whatnot. We all, I think, noticed this. I did. I took notice immediately and I thought, goodness, this is an inverted head and shoulder. This is the bottom on the XAU. And I looked at gold and silver and saw similar patterns unfolding. And then, you know, around 2002 to 2003, it became even more apparent. You could accumulate there from 2002 to 2003, 4, 5, 6, and you still caught the bulk of the move from 2001 to 2012. So, you know, this 12-year rally, you didn't have to catch it right away to get on board that locomotive, and did it ever steam away at breakneck speed? Catching the exact bottom, maybe not so important for traders if that's your calling. Not many folks, though, I think, make that a lifelong profession. I don't expect there to be a sudden snapback that where we all miss the bottom on this. So why be in such a hurry to find a bottom? Let the markets telegraph it to us. For instance, the housing crash gave us 3 or 4 years of a solid downtrend, then bounced along the bottom for 2 or 3 years, and then started a very noticeable uptrend. And it's remained an uptrend ever since. Will that change? Well, it could. But until then, let's just obey the primary autocorrelation, if you will, or serial correlation, long memory. You can use insert any term you like for the prevailing theme or trend, up or down, up or down? Well, right now, it's obviously not up. Okay, that's putting it nicely. So no reason to get overweighted on exposure there. Always smart to keep a component. But until we see that change, I wouldn't make it the primary focus. Instead, let's look at markets that are showing long-term status, that have turned around. For instance, the U.S. dollar, ticker symbol UUP, and even short-term treasuries, the SHY you can take a look at, 30-year treasuries, TLT, but keep in mind there's a lot more volatility there and higher interest as well. These are areas where you can, you know, start to consider adding a component to your portfolio slowly over time, and as that component grows in value, you might consider adding more through dollar cost averaging, for instance. As for having to catch the precise bottom, I would leave that for the Jesse Livermores of the world, and we all know how that story ended. We don't want to try to catch that. You know, as he pointed out, you know, the top dollar and the bottom dollar of any market move are the most expensive because everybody's trying to reach it.
Hey, Chris. This is Bob in Texas. I wanted to ask a question regarding a lot of this talk involved about bank bail-ins and the possibility of those coming to the United States. Do you think these are going to possibly be your banks with large derivative books and large mortgage books, or is it going to be across the board, banks in general? I'm just curious if maybe you could find a small hometown bank that won't experience a bail-in because it's got good financial conditions. I just want to see what your thoughts are on that. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And up next, it's Bob in Texas. He's concerned about the theme of bank bail-ins with large derivatives exposure, mortgage-backed securities, CDOs, credit default obligations, CDSs, credit default swaps, and many other toxic leveraged instruments, which, as we all know by now, starting in 2006-2007, were integral to causing the credit crisis, or at least an underpinning there. If you haven't already downloaded and found a copy of Frank Portnoy's Fiasco, maybe I can find that here and post it for this weekend. He outlines exactly how derivatives hide the true risk. They mask it. They're not transparent. They're opaque. The reality is that no institution, I think, is completely shielded from toxic derivatives. Once the next credit crisis begins in earnest, I think what you'll start to find is that very few of the pros were able to discern which firms were hiding those financial weapons of mass destruction, as Warren Buffett calls them. Now, as for your local bank's idea, this is very solid. I think your local and municipal credit unions and banks offer the most protection, but still, I'd suggest looking for alternatives and diversifying when you can. You really just don't want too many eggs in one basket when it comes to banking exposure. Precious metals, excellent alternatives. James Turk's gold money looks promising. I suspect that we could be entering a period of market volatility that might just lead to a huge unraveling of the financial markets, which could catch billions of investors off guard. Keeping that in mind, as well as the fact that no prediction is 100%, everyone is convinced their ideas are right. What if this turns out to just be a little hiccup on the way to new highs in equities? And bonds lose favor. So that's why having that core diversified portfolio is just so great. And keeping, you know, as Nassim Nicholas Taleb likes to point out, of anti-fragile, fooled by randomness, black swan, and so many others. As he's pointed out, Professor Taleb points out that we really need to keep a good solid 10% at least in cash available, keep something in reserve so as these markets collapse, as we've seen lately, you can add to your portfolios. And that solid, diversified portfolio will, over time, outperform virtually every professional that you come in contact with. So it's just a fantastic means to financial success. Stay with us right here. Axel Merck, President and CIO of Merck Investments, manager of the Merck Funds, as well as author of Sustainable Wealth. Welcome back, Mr. Merck.
Great to be with you.
You've noted recently that even if the Fed raises rates, it could be ill-timed, that they just simply are not keeping in step with the interest rate and monetary policy, for that matter, around the world?
Well, intentionally so, I might say. Since the spring, I believe, April of 2014, the last paragraph of the FOMC statement says that even as they will start to raise rates, and that would be because the GDP growth and inflation goes back to what is historically be considered normal, rates will likely be lower than what is considered normal. Now, they use fancy words, but basically the Fed is all but promising, and that's my interpretation, to be behind the curve. Bernanke was pretty good at articulating that. He said when you're faced with a credit bust, you don't want to be raising rates too early. You want to, and that's my interpretation, err on the side of inflation, because if you raise rates too early, odds are the deflationary forces will take over again. And so Yellen doesn't have this framework of the Great Depression. She uses employment as an excuse. But it's ultimately the same thing, that they want to be behind the curve, they want inflation to go up, and the only problem they have, of course, the moment they're trying to take the foot off the accelerator, the world keeps crashing down. And the reason that happens, by the way, is that Fed policy have inflated asset prices, and the moment you step away from that, asset prices come back down. And when you've tried to boost economic growth with asset price inflation, well, guess what? When asset prices come down, it also causes headwind to the real economy.
But with the upcoming political drama in 2016, you know, November presidential election, do you feel that perhaps the Fed governors and policymakers, although you say clearly they've painted themselves into a corner, that if they're going to act, they may have to act soon because they certainly wouldn't want to be seen as making waves or taking any political stance amid the election season?
Well, they're worried about so many different things. I think they haven't even noticed that the election is coming up next year. Central banker, you may like them or not, but they should set policy. They should kind of set the guidepost upon which to price things. You can price risk based on what the Federal Reserve is going to do. The problem we are in is that this so-called, quote-unquote, data-dependent Fed is reading the tea leaves like everybody else. So they're reacting to the latest move in the stock market, to the latest this and that, and they don't quite know what they're doing, and so they get worried about the Chinese sneezing or something happening in this part of the world or that part of the world, and so that gets them to have their hands tied, and ultimately some people say, well, it's better than to make a promise and then not live up to it. I don't know. I mean, you look at what's going to happen, you set the course and you adjust according to the reality. Now, the election itself, I don't think that's going to be the key driver here. I think the bigger issue they have is Mr. Market itself, that the rising volatility in the market, which had to come sooner or later, is going to tie their hands, because what a rising volatility does is it makes investors more risk averse. And the whole point of QE and of all this money printing was to take risk away, that things are no longer risky. Investing in anything is quote-unquote risk-free. Well, of course it isn't, but risk premium had been compressed. Junk bonds don't yield anything anymore, and volatility in the stock market had been low. And now as the Fed is trying to engineer an exit, risk is coming back with a vengeance.
Now, as you've noted in the past, what the Fed does when they essentially issue a put for investors is reduce volatility and risk to virtually null, and that has the effect, if you will, of leading to complacency. I mean, for instance, obviously investors start to just get used to the idea, well, stocks always move up. It's happened since 2009. Obviously, the Fed is there. They have our backs. A monetary policy, the plunge protection team, is certainly a strong combination. However, as you know, Nassim Taleb just found out, and so did his hedge fund investors, you can make $1 billion in a week if you prepare for spikes in volatility. And that's certainly what we've seen lately. Should investors be bracing for more volatility?
Well, the world is, of course, still risky. And what happens, and yes, is the short answer, but what happens is when, say, the stock market is rising and rising and rising on a backdrop of low volatility, then people put in the money not appreciating how risky these markets are. And so, of course, markets are still risky. When risk comes back to the market, investors will say, I didn't sign up for that. And so, of course, the time to diversify your portfolio is always during the good times, but in practice, that rarely ever happens. And so now, I believe the shift that has happened in recent weeks is rather than the glass being half full, investors will now look at the glass half empty. Because what they should have done, they should have taken some chips off the table. But the problem is, of course, where on earth do you put your chips? You get 0% interest on in cash, and if you put your money in bonds, well, good luck. They might be going down in a rising interest rate environment. And so we've been approached by folks that say, well, what about a put option strategy or this or that? And it says, yeah, we can do that, but ultimately it means you just have too much money in the stock market, right? Now that volatility is back, people are coming back from the summer break, and they realize, well, maybe I should put some of the stuff into more secure places. And that, of course, happens not just with retail investors. Any professional investor, when volatility is up, is paring down leverage as well. And, of course, when everybody does it together, asset prices come down. And that's why we have been warning. We came out in early August with a note that shorting the market and not just being in cash. And people said, why on earth would a currency and precious metals guy talk about the stock market? And then 2 weeks later said, oh, it's because of currencies that the markets are crashing. So it is time to be very careful in this market, both on a fundamental and on a technical level, but also from the metrics we look at, which is a lot of it is complacency driven, meaning complacency is our biggest bubble indicator that we have. We are extremely concerned about the markets right now.
There is diversification. Obviously, investors can turn to this, the free lunch, if you will. However, it's becoming harder to find balanced portfolio, or harder to hide, if you will, from volatility, as many of these markets have become highly correlated. And I think we see this just across the board. Investors used to be able to turn, let's say, to stocks and bonds and throw in a little bit of precious metals. But in a deflationary environment, all three of those asset classes could find themselves in trouble. Are you recommending currency exposure? For instance, the greenback has done remarkably well. It's in a solid uptrend. Give us your idea on the currency markets, please.
Well, first of all, there is no easy answer. If you look at the correction in August as well, anything that was the slam dunk went the other direction. And by all means, one of the things you might have noticed, you just mentioned the greenback, the dollar was rising over the past year. Well, it was rising on the backdrop of a rising stock market. That's not supposed to happen. What's supposed to be happening is that the dollar is rising in the flight to quality. And so sure enough, when the markets came tumbling down in August, the dollar was falling at the same time. You couldn't hide in the traditional safe haven places. The reason for that was, of course, partially anyway, that everybody, quote unquote, everybody hated the euro. People were short the euro. People used it as a funding currency for carry trades, whatever way you want to call it. And then when volatility came up, people lowered their exposure. And when you lower your exposure, you have to buy back the euro. And so that's how you can have these awkward things happening. I would not recommend people to kind of go all out and buy the greenback, because everybody else loves the greenback. Everybody else has rising rates. We have rising rates and whatnot. Everything looks great in the U.S. In my view, things are not perfect in the U.S., and things are not quite as bad in the rest of the world. There's too much good news priced into the dollar. And ultimately, and we see that with the sort of when you have overexposed position, what can happen? What you can do with currencies is you can design a portfolio that has a low correlation to something else. Say you take a position of the euro versus the Swedish crown, the Australian dollar versus the New Zealand dollar. Now, clearly, most people won't do that and can't do that. But what you can do with that is you can generate by design a return stream that is not correlated to your portfolio. And that's why investors, I think, should at least have a look at some of these alternative strategies, because as you point out, things are highly correlated. How do you hide? How do you diversify? Bernanke talked about a toolbox. That's why I think it's very valuable to have a toolbox available to be ready for what's ahead. And I think the time has come for if volatility is going to be elevated, if asset price is going to come down, for strategies that are long-short strategies, be it on the currency side, maybe on the equity side, or some other areas. Obviously, all of these have their own sets of risks and pitfalls, but you've got to think out of the box for the environment. That's it.
One asset class that has safe haven properties, at least in some economic environments, the precious metals. Sometimes viewed as a currency, even the currency of last resort, this asset class has suffered in recent years. Do you see any silver lining? Do you see any light on the horizon for precious metals investors and aficionados?
Think about it. I mean, we talked about things out of favor. Gold is out of favor by most people. Stocks are in favor. Well, from that point of view alone, it's worth looking at it. Then I mentioned earlier that, in my view, the Fed is all but promising to be behind the curve. A rising rate environment, in my view, matters less so than where real interest rates are. Gold, being a brick, obviously doesn't pay any interest and is a good competitor to cash when you don't get compensated holding cash. I don't think you get compensated for cash. I don't think we're going to get compensated properly anyway for cash going forward if the Fed is behind the curve. I don't think we can afford positive real interest rates in a decade from now. And as such, I think gold plays a good role. And then on top of that, gold does have, in the long run anyway, a near zero correlation to equities, another reason to consider gold. Now, I do have to say, I did chat with a, at the time, active FOMC, policymakers at the FOMC, and mentioned my view that, hey, I don't think we can afford positive real interest rates in a decade from now. And he said, he looked at me and says, well, he doesn't think that's possible because that wouldn't create a stable equilibrium. And my response was, I never said it's going to be stable.
Well, as we wrap up today, can you tell investors any other markets you're watching or perhaps any other topicality that you think's pertinent for our listeners?
The good old basic thing is that you always want to be properly diversified, but it doesn't mean the same thing as it meant in the past, because just being diversified to different industries doesn't cut it. Odds are investors are overexposed to stocks because they've been riding the wave up. Take chips off the table, consider doing that. And then beyond that, think out of the box. I mean, we have currency mutual funds, we have a gold ETF. Those are all things investors can look at, but ultimately it is about trying to see how can one be defensive in a world where everybody is pushed into risky assets. And that also means leaving chips off the table. You don't have to chase every rally that's out there. You want to have chips on the table for when the markets come down, that you have some firing power to go back into the markets.
Please tell people more about Merck Investments as well as the Merck Funds.
Yeah, sure. Come to our website, merckinvestments.com, and we have a free newsletter. I tweet a lot. If you want to have instantaneous interpretation on the news, follow me on Twitter. Axel Merck is my handle. We do have three currency mutual funds and a gold ETF. All of that you can find on our website. There are links to there. But I, as a first step, follow me on Twitter and then sign up for our newsletter if you want to hear more about our views. We also have a webinar coming up on how to prepare for a potential crash. Information on that is on our website as well. And so come to our website and learn more about what we do.
One interesting note about the gold, or at least fund that you manage there, as I understand it, looking over the literature, this is actually a deliverable fund. Can you tell investors more?
Yes, certainly. We have a gold ETF that holds London bars in London. Investors holding the gold ETF have a pro rata ownership in the underlying gold. Investors may at any time request delivery. Most people don't, but our delivery feature is not just theoretical. It's a real one. You can request delivery of the London bars, but when you request delivery, you can also request an exchange into coins. And so you can literally have American Gold Eagles or very common coins delivered to your doorstep. The process takes a good week, and it's scalable. We can, if we had a rush of people trying to take delivery, we can do it, and we have done it in practice. The ETF tracks the price of gold, and so it acts like an ETF, but it is deliverable, and it's something for some investors to look at.
Well, that's remarkable, because I think it's clear that many of these top ETFs, including StreetTrax Gold ETF, the top GLD ticker symbol, simply they do have the option of deliverability, but you have to be a major player. As I understand it, it's typically in excess of $1 million of an ETF invest, oftentimes substantially more. It's really up to the discretion of the fund manager, so there's no guarantees that anybody owns these ETF shares. I hope our listeners will invest or at least take a look at the literature. Is there a ticker symbol you'd like to share today?
Yes, the ticker is OUNZ, and of course guarantees is another word that this industry likes to use, but yes, this is a deliverable gold ETF where investors may request delivery of the gold. It trades like an ETF, and you can take delivery of the physical gold. And oh, by the way, one very nice feature, in my view anyway, is that taking delivery in itself is not a taxable event. That means if you have a appreciated shares of the Merck Gold Trust, and you decide to that you'd rather own the coin instead, that like, oh, the time has come, I'd like to have a coin at home, or I'd like to have them shipped to Canada or somewhere else, and we can make that happen. That in itself is not a taxable event because you already own the gold, you're just taking delivery of it. And that is something that if you own other gold ETFs, even if they claim that they provide delivery, usually you'd have to sell the ETF, pay potential taxes, and then with the proceeds you can buy the coin, whereas with ours you can actually just take delivery of what you already own.
O-U-N-Z. Look into this ticker symbol. We appreciate your thoughts. Please keep up the great work and hopefully return to our show soon.
My pleasure.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
David Morgan writes the Morgan Report, runs silver-investor.com. Welcome back, David Morgan.
Thank you, Chris, for having me back.
David, you know, we were talking before the show about a very interesting article with someone you're associated with, David H. Smith, and it's just this BSOD. To summarize here succinctly, the idea is simple, it's straightforward. We could wake up in the next 6 to 12 months, and these markets could correct. Precious metals, that is, and particularly silver, but not so much in the direction that everyone's gotten accustomed to over the last 3 or 4 years, skyward. Why don't you give people an idea of what David Smith is talking about here?
Well, David is independent, and he's worked with me for years. We're roughly the same age. He's a little older than me, and he actually found me at the first or second, I think it was the second Silver Summit, approached me, as many people did, and of course the same first name, and being Silver Bulls for, you know, on and off for quite some time, and I think one of our daughters were named the same, and I mean, on and on it went. So as things progressed, you know, it was a pleasure really to have David help me out, because, you know, being the lone cowboy's fun, but, you know, two heads are better than one, and of course later we have Chris Marchese, and I had my webmaster almost from day one. I think for maybe a year I did it all on my own. But the point being is David's a great thinker, a great writer, and he does a great deal of writing for the Morgan Report. So a lot of the mining trips that we take and we report and we film, he films as well. And it's all legitimate. I mean, all that gear is required. So he's out there with all this stuff, and he does an excellent job for us on these mine excursions, doing the video blog, which are for our members only, and of course doing the write-up as well. So David wrote this article, Blue Screen of Death. And what he says in this article, most people know what that means, but just a quick review, it's a seldom occurring event that happens on a computer, and most of us these days have one or two or more. And so Wikipedia defines it as a poorly written device or driver's malfunctioning hardware, such as a faulty memory, power supply issues, overheating components, or whatever. And along that thinking, he says, this is kind of where we've been in the gold and silver markets for a very long time. We've had this cyclical bear trend within what David and I and a few others are left to still think it's a secular bull market. So where does this situation leave us? And it leaves us staring at this blue screen of death, thinking, my goodness, you know, are these things ever coming to life? Is this over? You know, and of course, you know, many of us have questioned that. And yours truly, certainly in my weaker moments, thought, you know, it's a possibility. I'm not addicted to being right. But, you know, all of my market study, everything I've looked at, goes on the basis that the only time that this would be the end would be one, the third leg up, which we haven't had, And two, it gets into the mainstream in such a strong manner that it starts to go into the mainstream press, meaning you see, you know, buy gold, it's going to 10,000, and that's on the cover of Time magazine, or Newsweek says, buy gold before it's too late, or something along those lines. That has not happened yet. I really believe that we're looking at a historic opportunity in the metals. I called the bottom for, I think, the third time. I think I've been wrong twice. I've been close. I mean, if that counts, and depending on who you are and how you trade, if you're highly leveraged, close doesn't count. But we had that 1817 low that held for 14 months, and that was breached. And then we got this 1450 intraday spike low, and it was spike in the terms of volume and price, and that held up until very recently. And we got slightly under that on the close in the main COMEX in Chicago, and I think it was 1411, if I remember correctly. And that was a new low, but it also could be a double bottom. I mean, a double bottom doesn't necessarily get to the exact point. Now, is it a double bottom? And the answer is I don't know. And the answer is I will know.
David, I think we could start to have a better idea on that conditional probability within the next 2 weeks, don't you, with the impending FOMC?
Yeah, I would say two or three more weeks of data based on what the volume shows. Then we'll have a pretty clear picture. So let me just explain that for people that don't know the part of technical analysis that's really important, and that is price and volume. So if we saw much better prices, it wouldn't have to be significantly higher, but much better volume and a decrease in the COT, that would be such strong indications to me. Depending on the numbers, I would say that's it. It's a double bottom, you know, because most of my contemporaries are thinking, well, it's going to go to 12 or it's going to go to 10, and have asked, you know, and the answer is, I really don't know. Could it? I hardly rule out anything in the silver market. I just want to come a little bit back to the blue screen of death, because David and I, you know, discussed this a little bit as he was writing it, and he asked, you know, what was that, you know, famous expression, take my ego and just blow it off. I use it to be funny. But I said, the expression I coined on the Jim Poplava show so many years ago is that silver will wear you out or scare you out. Yeah. So he references that, and he says, certainly this has worn us out. This thing's been over 4 years. He just used that quote, and then he talked about how production is falling off in the silver market. We've got a very good setup for most of the people in the boat on one side saying it can only go lower, I'm through silver as soon as it gets back to where I paid for it, I'm out. I don't want to ever hear the word again. And you've got a very few that are contrarians to the contrarians, meaning that they say, yeah, I think that David Morgan, he gets it right most of the time, and I don't expect him to be perfect. And I'm not really upset with him buying silver at the $18 level. And yeah, I'm buying at 14. I have a long-term plan, and I'm only going to put this much of my net worth in the metals. I'm not putting everything in my life into the metals, and that type of thinking. And they're like ready for what's coming. But there aren't many of them left, and that's okay. I mean, you know, I can't control a market. I certainly can analyze one, but to get it perfect every time, none of us can do that. Having said all of that, let me just say that I feel fairly confident that due to sentiment, seasonalities, price action, volume, and all we've talked about, Chris, that I would feel very, very good, especially if I was starting out. I mean, I'd love to, because this way I look at it from a metric, and we did this in the Morgan Report for our paid members only, and it was a pretty extensive study, but it's based on the true money supply. And this doesn't make us right. It doesn't make us wrong. It's an academic study, but it gives a good idea. If you base the price of silver versus the true money supply in 2000 versus the price of silver versus the true money supply today, guess what? They're almost identical.
When did that metric get to such favorable levels valuation-wise?
A few months back. Yeah, it's in this range. It isn't when we hit 14. It was actually in the 15 or 16 range.
And you'll notice that we haven't really seen a change in trend with regard to, you know, the St. Louis Fed's numbers on the money supply. I haven't seen a rollover at all in their monthly notation of behind-the-scenes money printing. And we're still on track to something, what is it, $4.4 trillion since the credit crisis.
Exactly. I mean, others have noted that same exact thing. And we're in a position now that, and we have been for quite some time. I mean, we've navigated through the 2008 financial crisis from that point that, you know, it happened and till now. But the way I look at it was the navigation was a sailboat with a half mast and a broken sail. And we've been wandering aimlessly across the sea, and so far we're still afloat.
We need everything that we can have that's a safe haven against the ship going down. I guess it's almost a tired cliche, but it's appropriate. We're looking at an equities market fiasco, okay, and we all know what happened in 2007 when that began. Sure, it took several months. It was the end of 2007, I think, until most people were aware of the fact that things were looking choppy. The waters were getting choppy. But 2008, 2009 are a couple of years that all but the most fleet-footed shorts would like to forget.
Well, I'm going to just go back to the article because I think it's a great way to sum up this interview. And so David writes at the end, so how would a silver blue screen of death event look? Possibly. And here he goes. It's Sunday evening. It's in the overnight markets, and the price of silver rises $2 an ounce. In pre-opening trading the next day, silver stock ETFs opened 50% higher. American Silver Eagles and Canadian Maple Leafs sell out in a few hours. Premiums on junk silver triple from the previous day's level. Local coin shops sell out of physical silver by noon the next day. Silver moves up sharply each day and ends the week $15 higher. Over the next 2 weeks, silver reaches just 25% of its meteoric rise, forming what technicians call a bull flag. On the third Monday, the moonshot continues, easily breaking through multi-year resistance at 38 and then 44. And finally, the all-time nominal high above $50 an ounce, closing a few weeks later above $70 per ounce. For several months, the price forms a broad trading range below a spike high at 80, but is unable to drop below the $55 an ounce level. Almost no one believes this is happening. No retail metal is available, and when it is, the premium is $15 over spot. Primary silver-producing stocks trade well above their 2011 highs, and in some cases, 50 times higher from their bear market lows. Unlike 1980, silver trading this time is a global phenomena. Internet news is instantaneous, with the Chinese market setting the price. The COMEX has defaulted on its futures contracts and settles by paying out paper promises. So I think that's a good scenario. Is that going to happen? I don't know. But I want to backtrack, Chris, if you could just give me a little bit more time and go through the top three or four and comment on them. One is the overnight markets rise $2 to $4 an ounce. Didn't happen yet. In pre-opening trading, ETFs open high percentages higher. But here's the couple that I want to comment on. American Silver Eagles and Canadian Maple Leafs sell out in a few hours. Well, basically, we've been allocating both American Eagles and Maples now for quite some time, which means that allocation only goes to what they call primary dealers. These are the kind of guys who could write a check for $1 million, $2 million, $10 million. I mean, these are big retail shops. Some are wholesalers that sell to the retail shops. And this is really taking place. And then the premiums on junk silver triple from the previous day's level. Let me comment on that, Chris, because I want to get this right. I spent a full day, I mean like a 10-hour day, and I used to do this, used to do it actually once a month. I don't do it that often anymore. I do still take the time to do this, and what I do is I survey some of the biggest wholesalers in the country. Some of these guys have wholesale shops and retail shops.
You get on the horn, David, and you call your contacts in the precious metals community to get a feel.
Exactly. I'm asking them, you got a lot of product, and is there a short on any of them, and, what's the demand side like? I ask them all the questions you'd want to know, and I don't do it to, excuse the arrogance, and it's not arrogant. It's just a waste of time to call the coin dealer on the corner I'm talking, the Mike Maloney's, I'm talking these big, big guys, Dylan Gage. I'm talking people that move size on metal, A-mark, those type of things. So I survey them, and I don't take one answer. I go across the board, and I have several. So anyway, I said to this one last one I forgot to ask, is the junk bag market tight? I was told by others it was extremely. Here's the answer. Extremely, paying $4 to $4.50 premium, and we cannot find them.
Junk silver, does that not generally trade at or even below sometimes the market?
Absolutely. It generally trades below melt. And now it's trading $4.50, and the wholesalers can't find any in size. And I wrote that in the Morgan Report. I mean, it wasn't just me. We asked one of our favorite coin dealers, Richard Natchbar, if he would allow us to use his chart in our report. And we've had a great rapport for years, and he is just a super guy. And he said, oh, sure, you can use my chart. So we, of course, accredited Richard Natchbar for making the chart and showing the premiums on silver bags. And I said in the Morgan Report, and I think it's been 2 months now, it's been recent, that this is usually a precursor to higher silver prices. And, of course, they've gone down from there. I admit that. It's not a perfect timing device. So what I'm trying to state is that this market is about as strange as I've ever seen it. I've been in the silver market more or less since I was 11 years old, certainly not the level I am now, and certainly not, you know, I mean, from a teenager through college, I thought about the markets, read about the markets, was obsessed with them almost, but certainly wasn't a big investor. I mean, I'm paying for college. But the point being that I studied these markets for a long time, and in all of that history, I've never seen a market where you have these kind of premiums on junk silver, a tightness in government-issued coins, and India buying such a massive amount of physical silver, and these prices being able to maintain these low levels for this long. I mean, I thought if we saw something below the $18 level, it would probably be a momentary event to, for example, spike down to, say, 16, remain there for, you know, a few days, perhaps 3 days, and then pop back up to 18. That's kind of what I expected, and I'll tell the truth. I thought that would be the case, but I'm wrong. It's been at these levels, but it's getting stranger and stranger by the day. How can you have these massive demands of, and yet the price remains where it is? Well, we all know the answer to that.
Another thing that you've underscored in previous shows and in lots of your work and research and papers and whatnot, this is a small market. It doesn't even take, with leverage today, one financial institution, just one Warren Buffett. It only takes one deep pocket, pension funds, institutions. We know they're trying to hold up their Fata Morgana here. It takes some key components, and the silver market, they're whipping it around any way they want to. And maybe, just maybe, that's one of the pieces to this puzzle behind this disconnect we're seeing between reality, supply and demand, the invisible hand, and actual, you know, prices. Before we wrap up here, I'd like your comments on whether or not we need a bottom. You know, why do we have to pick a bottom? I mean, shouldn't we be focusing on the fact that it has incredible relative value? It's, as you mentioned, 60-70% off its recent peak. Talk about a valuation there. It's a wonderful insurance policy against an extremely overvalued equities market, not to mention bond market, not to mention, once again, real estate is starting to, I think, push the envelope, the ceiling on valuations yet again, like we didn't just learn our lesson back in 2009. You know, silver, gold, you know, the other side of the pendulum. That's what we're thinking about here. Let's protect our portfolio. We don't need the absolute bottom. We don't have to be overweighted, but we better have 20 or 30% in the portfolio. Any comments there?
No, well said. I mean, I just go back to the 20-year bear market. And one very good technician, in my view, worked at BMO. I believe it was BMO, and I forget his name. I have his card here somewhere. But, you know, I was in my second year on the speaking circuit or whatever, and he did a great presentation. And I was training for triathlons back then. And he talked about the longer the base, the bigger the move, you know. And of course I related that to triathlon training, because you have to build what's called a base. You have to build this incredible amount of endurance before you, you know, jump into a triathlon. And it's called building a base. And so I thought that was a very interesting analogy to, you know, what I've been training, doing training wise. And of course this is similar. I mean, we've built a base around the 18 level, 20 level. I mean, look at a chart. The point is, if you look back at the 20-year bear market, you'll see this long line. And that was the base that was being built. Can you say when the bottom was? Well, I got lucky or skillful or whatever and called the bottom. It was really September 2003. And what does that mean? It means that that's when it finally got above 555. I still remember the exact number, and it held that level and went above it. And that was the breakout point on the charts. And I'm not, you know, I do technical work, but I put both fundamentals and technical together. I think it's the best way to look at the market. You know, if you have a hammer and a screwdriver, why not use both the tools when appropriate? But regardless, got lucky on that one or not, or the market told me. I trade differently than almost anybody that teaches trading. I trade by the market telling me. what to do, not by me to tell the market where I think it should.
That's how you get in trouble, isn't it? If you start saying, I know more, I'm smarter than everybody who's been looking at these markets 10, 20, 30, 40 years, I'm going to go with what the market is telling you, what it is doing, where it is going, where the momentum is, and put aside my opinions. I think that's good advice.
Well, I want to add one thing, Chris, and then you're going to ask about the site. So the best thing you can do if you're not on the free list is to get on the free list, and here's why. To get on the free list, go to silver-investor.com, scroll all the way to the bottom. We only ask you for two things, some kind of name, first, last, or make one up, but a valid email. Then you'll get an email to that address that you have to verify that that is you. And once that's accomplished, then we'll send you every Saturday interviews like this that you'll get. So you won't miss any of the interviews. And you have to listen to them all, and some people want all of them. Some people want to listen to one or have a favorite or whatever. The reason I'm saying all this, Chris, is that I'm going to be interviewed in the next few days by USA Watchdog. And what he is going to ask me is, how bad will it get? And this is a question that I think almost anybody in the gold-silver camp has asked themselves many, many times, and everyone really wants an answer to that. Well, how bad is it going to get? You know, am I going to need to store food? Do I need extra water? I mean, am I going to lose my job? I mean, is the currency going to go to zero? I mean, all these questions. And you know what? The answer that I have is, I don't know. But I have a really, really good documentary called The Empty ATM that I will be putting out the URL to on YouTube to everybody that is on the free list. So the list I just said isn't obligating you in any way other than to get on our mailing list, and you can jump off anytime you want. So for the next month or so, what I'm going to do for the question of the week, rather than answer a question from a member or a subscriber, is I'm going to just say, you asked for it, here it is. How bad could it get? Watch this movie. Please forward this. Tell your friends and neighbors or anyone you think might be interested, because that's a documentary that shows exactly what happened in the 2001 currency crisis in Argentina.
David Morgan, the silver investor. We'll look forward to hearing your thoughts later on in the year. Thank you, David Morgan.
My pleasure.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. An eye-opening and not so unexpected article appeared on Bloomberg this past week regarding the U.S. housing situation. The headline, almost half of homes in New York and D.C. are now losing value. A new home price index developed by Weiss Residential Research indicates a warning sign for some property markets. The real estate market is critical to the U.S. economy, but the high prices in major markets that we've talked about on this broadcast before may be reaching a saturation point. According to the Bloomberg article this past week, almost half of single-family houses in New York and Washington metropolitan areas are losing value, indicating the tolerance people have endured for high prices in many large U.S. cities may be reaching or may have reached an end. The value of nearly half, as in 45% of the houses in Washington and New York, dropped at least 2% in June from a year prior, according to a new index called the Repeat Sales Index, created by Alan Weiss, who was co-founder of the Case-Shiller Home Price Indexes. As a comparison, in June of 2014, only 15% of Washington homes dropped in value, while 20% of homes fell in New York. More properties declined in Los Angeles, Chicago, Phoenix, and Miami. The analysis of the housing market is not that flattering. Homes are less affordable. Incomes are weak. Home prices have risen gradually but not recovered since the 2008 collapse. According to the new index, credit is still tight, and housing demand is being driven primarily by buyers who are dependent on mortgages because foreign buyers and investors have pulled back from the market. The foreign purchasing component to housing has never been fully acknowledged or thoroughly discussed in mainstream financial media as an important component of our supposed recovery. But now that it's gone missing, it is beginning to be openly discussed. Fancy that. According to Chris Whalen, who is Senior Managing Director at Kroll Bond Rating Agency and an advisor to the index created by Alan Weiss, he says what happens in any bull asset bubble, such as what we've seen, is you run out of buyers. It's hard to get deals done if the bottom third can't get a mortgage. If foreign buyers are exiting the market, and now the U.S. economy and the housing market in particular is going to have to rely on the bottom third of consumers who cannot acquire a mortgage, coupled with the fact we are already in a permanent re-election cycle for 2016, presidential and otherwise, you can bet your last silver dollar that quantitative easing will come out in full force, new and improved, and likely with unexpected and novel delivery mechanisms designed to liquefy the markets and the ability of the bottom third to get back in the debt accumulation game. The Fed's internal motto is likely inflate or die. They'll inflate until they can't. And once they can no longer inflate, there will be only one thing left to do. It'll be like running out of fuel at 30,000 feet. You'll have to land eventually. Are you preparing yourself for a hard landing, a soft landing, or a different kind of flight altogether? The future is not something you will have to endure. You do have some say in it, because still, right now, you have a significant opportunity to prepare for and create exactly the kind of future you want when we emerge from the other side of a global economic reset that will ultimately transform itself into a true economic, societal, and technological renaissance. That is the kind of change to keep focused on. Not so much the reset itself, but on how you are going to emerge from the other side and build a new paradigm for generations to come. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. Several years ago, I hosted a series of teleseminars on gold and the economy, and I'll soon begin hosting a series of free Conquer Change webinars. And if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers for their companies or professional organizations, please visit my companion website at robertian.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.